Our guest on our latest episode of Soundtrackin' has probably been mentioned almost as many times on this podcast as John Williams and Hans Zimmer. Warren Ellis is a musician and composer who is a member of Dirty Three, Grinderman and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and has also written several film scores with Nick in addition to his solo projects. Now, Warren was kind enough to join me whilst in isolation at his Paris studio to talk about his career and, well, this strange and worrying crisis humanity finds itself in. Before we get to that, a word from our friends at Babbel. Now, given that you probably have a little bit of time on your hands at the moment, now presents the perfect opportunity to learn a new language or just brush up on one you studied at school but has long since been forgotten. Maybe you're homeschooling like me, but you haven't got the foggiest idea when it comes to French, Spanish or German. With its clear and simple interface, Babbel guides you through your learning journey in a funny and smooth way. It's designed to get you speaking your new language within weeks with daily lessons, teaching real-life conversations through interactive dialogues. Lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts, that is real people, and not a translation machine. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages and the teaching method has been proven to be effective across multiple studies. Babbel is available as an app or online and your progress will be synced across all devices. Try Babbel today. Just go to babbel.co.uk or download the app for free. That's Babbel, babbel.co.uk or download the app to try for free. Babbel, learn a new language and make it your own. And so to the lovely Warren, who we can't thank enough for joining us. We'll begin with a cue from his most recent score, which is for Arnaud Bichet's beautiful documentary called This Train I Ride. It's called I'll Hop Trains for the Rest of My Life. You still good? You can still hear me?
I can, yeah. You sound good now.
Fabulous.
I'm just going through my phone.
Yeah, that's great. It sounds brilliant, this end.
Oh, good. Yeah, they're awesome. I've used this many times for recordings.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Where would we be without technology in this particular state as well?
Well, it's pretty incredible, actually, because keeping everything close and yet we're sort of so cut off. It's kind of amazing, really.
Yeah. Where are you in the world?
I'm in Paris, just outside of Paris.
And are you well? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. We have it in the house. My wife has it. She's okay. She's had it for 7 or 8 days now. I got my kid out of England. I was working.
Yeah.
So last weekend was kind of a bit anxious. I couldn't work out what was going on, but something, you know.
Yeah.
I've been following it for, I'd say, a good sort of month and a half, I guess. And also Nick was incredibly sort of he seemed really aware of it as well. And we've been working a lot together lately, so it was always on the table, you know, like what was going on. But I didn't see this coming at all.
No,
and
I don't think anyone did, really.
No, and you know, I'm taking it very seriously. I'm kind of isolated in my studio. I'm living in there now.
Yeah. We just moved out of London just before Christmas to out in Gloucestershire. Perfect timing, to be honest, but it's just been just to be able to let the kids kind of get some fresh air in the garden, my two boys, and we just started homeschooling today, which has been fun. I know absolutely jack shit about science, I discovered today.
Oh, I know. It's terrifying, isn't it? My older now. They're like 18 and 19 and a half. But, living in France, I remember being absolutely mortified when I realized I couldn't keep up with the maths I was doing in primary school. Yeah. It was just confounding. And then the rest of the stuff, you know, it was in French. I just forget it. You know, like I felt so useless. All my kind of images of helping my kids went out the window.
Yeah. Well, listen, the wonderful thing about this is that we can just, you know, I've been hoping to keep this podcast going so that I can give people a bit of respite.
Brilliant.
And within that, it's a lovely way of kind of going, oh, listen, if you haven't seen this, then so much stuff is available, you know, on streaming and on demand now that it's almost allowing people to take a breath and catch up with things that they hadn't seen or haven't watched or listened to for a while.
Yes, it sort of feels a bit privileged to say it's a great time to sort of read and watch things and listen to them, you know, because I have to say when I look around me, so many people are stuck in apartments with their families and stuff. So I can't imagine the duress that you're under. It seems a time to actually, that you have to internalize things in a lot of ways. It's the strangest of times.
Mm. Yeah,
our only reference is books and films for this sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It does feel like it hasn't even started really, you know, like it feels like it's, you know, like, I mean, I've been locked down since last Tuesday.
Yeah.
And it feels barely like the beginning, you know, like I watching the sort of press conferences of Trump and Johnson just give you no sort of hope. Boris Johnson looks terrified.
Doesn't he? He's just
rightly so, too.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, dead behind the eyes, but with this kind of fear.
Yeah, and Trump is terrifying, too, because he's just becoming more and more insane, if that's possible.
Yeah.
It's just totally reprehensible what he's doing. You know, at a time when that country needs somebody, you know, with such a poor infrastructure for medical care and all that, he's still having a pissing competition.
Yeah, I have to say when I watched the, was it last week, I think, and Macron did that speech about, we're here for the people and about what the government were willing to put up for people in terms of just sort of financially supportive and all that kind of thing. And just how much he made those two look so incompetent and just, I just felt like he was a kind of league of his own, to be honest, in terms of how he stepped up to that kind of, even before we're in the position we are now with it, you know, and getting worse, he was just there and willing to kind of offer the people of France a lifeline.
It's definitely very lean, and it's lean and encouraging, you know, what he's doing. Like Merkel is like that too. I find her fascinating.
Yeah.
She's really kind of great like that as well. I've always liked her. Like, I think there's something, you can see this sort of aspect of a leader that you need.
And totally.
You can see everybody's turning towards these people.
Whether you believe in all their policies or not, it's the same with Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland. You know what I mean? She's a fantastic leader. Don't agree with her policies. But I think just in terms of stepping up and being a person who you trust and you go, you can ask for help and you know she's going to deliver.
Yeah, exactly. You need to step up. I remember like François Hollande was terrible, you know, as a thing. But when those sort of terrorist attacks happened, he was incredible.
Mm.
You know, he just got up and he suddenly just rose into something. It was like he was what everybody needed, you know, at that point. Like, and politically, you know, he's the biggest failure ever in most unpopular. I think Macron's beating him for unpopularity towards the end of the year with the sort of strikes and his sort of attempts to repackage things, you know, the retirements and all that. But actually, in these times, it actually draws out what you hope is going to be leadership qualities. Because, you know, looking at the sort of thing on the weekend with Boris Johnson and the two other people there, everybody was looking at them for what do we do?
Yeah.
The world is looking at these people now. Like, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, listen, should we talk about a little bit about work stuff and your wonderful. I mean, I watched The Train I Ride last week and I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic journey. And I want to almost encourage people to sit by a window with the window open so they can feel the air brushing through their hair whilst they watch this kind of documentary, because it does really physically take you on a journey with these people. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, it has such an extraordinary spirit, the documentary. Like, I hope it gets some kind of broader release because it's so marginal and, you know, it's a very small documentary. The guy who made it, like, he just reached out to me via email. I don't even know how he got in touch with me, but he'd been self-financed for his first two documentaries. They were about women as well.
Yeah.
And this one, he initially set out to track down the photographer who took all those incredible photos, Mike Brody, to track him down because he was curious why somebody with the whole kind of photograph all at his feet would just throw it all in. And he sort of took those series of images with Polaroids, you know, of train life and the communities around them of these sort of transient communities. And he went back to being a mechanic and he was really fascinated by it. And he met him in America. The guy wasn't interested about it because it all sort of landed badly in the end because his friends got pissed. He made money and they didn't. And so he just never took himself as a photographer. He just wanted to take these. He found the Polaroids in a trash, you know, the films and stuff like that. So he was really interested by this. And the guy just said, I'm not interested in talking to you. So then Arno was on sort of online chat rooms and stuff, like, because there's communities up there of people who do this sort of thing, this train hopping. And he noticed that there were women who did it on their own and he wondered why. So he then sort of set about meeting these people and asked one day one of them if he could go with them. He wanted to know why they would do this thing that's so dangerous. And I think when you see the video, you understand that it seemed incredibly sort of prescient when I watched it because there were women who had obviously troubled pasts and you know, some darkness in the past, and rather than be a victim to it, they found that this helped them overcome it by being responsible for themselves and the kind of actual, I think the sort of the sort of way that they rise out of it is so, like, beautiful.
Yeah.
It's so extraordinary and it's so encouraging.
Absolutely.
I really like that it's about regular people who are kind of trying to work their way out of something that's been thrown on them and that they've taken the situation into their own hands. I found that incredibly empowering and inspiring, you know. He sent me a couple of images and I thought they were so beautiful and I had a piece lying around and I sent a couple of pieces to him.
Yeah.
And he then edited a piece into sort of like a 5-minute snippet that he'd put together. And he came to Paris and I met him and he showed me and I just thought on the strength of that even if the rest of it was half as good, it would be something really special.
It was at night time. Hi. Saw a welder in the train yard welding on a car, the track. I saw the arc reflecting off of his hood and all the sparks flying. And it was only a few seconds, but that stayed with me for years. People telling me that I couldn't be a welder because I was a girl. Just like people told me I couldn't ride trains or travel by myself because I was a girl. survive. Don't need a problem solver. Don't need a savior.
I quite often do that with things. Also, the freedom that you have with smaller projects like this is really kind of liberating.
Yeah.
It allowed me to work in a certain way to free things up for me. Like, I find that much more interesting than jumping in the usual path that I know. Like a film like Bad Girl, a little sort of Australian sort of drama / teen drama horror film.
Yeah.
That psychological thriller or something, you know, that one, again, you know, very small budget, but I just recorded it on tour in a hotel room when I was touring with Dirty Three in Australia. I mixed it on the flight on the way back with a pair of headphones and a little speaker on the plane, and then referenced it in my car and made a couple of tweaks, and that was it.
That's amazing.
It's a bit sort of like now, you know, you have to work out how to do things so that the process continues, you know, because for me it's about making things and that's what I kind of, you know, I have to, at the moment, you know, I want to look after my family and continue working in some way.
Yeah, same.
So, you know, it's kind of great the accessibility that we have to things that enable us to continue working in some fashion.
I found the score for the Train I Ride, I thought it was such beauty and tenderness in it. You know, at the opening, it's really mellow, but you can sense a kind of, there's a kind of darkness behind it. But almost as the film goes on and we come to get to know these women better and we kind of see their strength and that they're not putting blame on anyone for their situation. They actually relish the situation they're in and they thrive on it really in a way. And the score really complements that with its kind of tenderness and the way that you've, the journey of the score almost alongside the narrative.
Yeah, I'd actually gone to see a retrospective of Wim Wenders at the Grand Palais in Paris, and they were projecting parts of his films all across the walls and stuff, and it was absolutely breathtaking. And the Paris, Texas scenes that they showed just blew my mind. Like, I remember
the
seeing
the Rocky Kudos soundtrack to that. It's just
I remember that and Wings of Desire. There was a couple of the films that just stood up head and shoulders. You know, like they were just so extraordinary in that format. You know, they were massive, like on the walls, and they were like 180 degrees all around the Grand Palais. And that gave me the idea, because there was such beautiful narrative in the documentary. It's women, what they were saying, these little internal meditations, because he literally kind of jumped on the train with them. He'd never done this train hopping before, and he told me, like, I was fascinated how he did it. And he said the first time he went, he was so scared. He just hung onto the rail, because you're sitting outside, like you see in the documentary.
Yeah.
You're not in a train. You're outside and you're hanging onto the sort of railing. He said he couldn't let go. He thought he was going to die for 14 hours because they jumped on the train and it didn't stop. And he said you can't imagine the noise. You can't imagine how cold it gets, the rain, and you cannot imagine how much it shakes around. And he said if you get on a carriage that's doesn't have very good suspension, it's just like an amusement park ride, one of those amusement park rides for 14 hours. And he said he thought he was going to die. Like, and he's like a big guy from Lyon, you know, he's an old punk from Lyon. And he sort of had this system of just charging up enough batteries for 2 weeks and then taking like 20 cereal bars from a sports store and a backpack and then jumping on the train with them. And he said he also had no idea that you had to jump off. So these women just like jumped off, and he said he could never work that out because you have to jump in the opposite sense that you think you should jump. So he sort of just jumped into this kind of thing without any clue what he was doing. It was kind of amazing to his story. And he said, you know, like you don't shower for 10 days or for 2 weeks. He said he caught a bus one time and he thought someone had died on the bus, and then he realized it was him. He just smelt, and he had to jump off and buy a bottle of really lousy perfume, you know, in a truck stop. But, you know, the thing I actually loved about it is the sort of closeness that he got with them. Like, they really let him in, which I found a real kind of sign of him as well, you know, like of actually the exchange between him, even though because he's the only person there with them, he doesn't have any other crew. That is really moving as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I basically kept making stuff up. I sort of make things on. I started doing it on the train with this idea. I don't know if you saw the liner notes.
No.
Okay. So what happened actually was I had this idea to record it on trains and the metro, because I was taking the train a lot in 2019, and it was while we were putting Ghosteen together, and I was going up to Berlin, and I was in London, and you know, I was heading to. It was sort of recorded all over the place, that record, and I was really transient, and I just thought, maybe I can record this on trains, because the budget was tiny, and you know, there was no studio. I couldn't do it in a studio, and as I said, I kind of like these projects that enable me, give me a lot more freedom, you know, than just sitting down and approaching it how I would in the studio. I started recording things on the metro, and I have my laptop, and I'd have my iPhone and record stuff on there, and I have sort of ideas that I hadn't used for things, and I just I'd get it on the metro or on the Eurostar, and I would just start sort of messing around and making pieces up and send them to him. And it actually started, it was an idea I had. I thought, oh, maybe this is an approach, and then
Brian Eno texted me because he was in Paris and we sort of been communicating but never met over probably a period of 18 months or something. He just texted me. I'd been at a therapy session and I was walking out of the metro and he texted me saying, you know, would you like to come and watch an orchestra rehearse? And I'd never met him before in person, and I sort of, of course, you know, so I went to the Châtelet Theatre, the Châtelet in Paris, and they were doing this Russian kind of installation called Dao, this was rather strange thing, project, and he'd done the sound installation. So, you know, I find myself sitting watching this orchestra, this Greek orchestra, orchestra, I think they're actually from Estonia, by this Greek conductor, and I'm sitting with Eno, you know.
Wow.
He's leaning over to me, you know, like going, listen to the bass and stuff like this, you know, and like, you know, Eno's like the guy that's probably in the fabric of everything that I do. Like Eno's the guy that I go back to, and I'm suddenly having this incredible moment, you know, this, you know, guy has shifted so many things for so many people. And then he's like, do you want to come and eat some cherry dumplings? And I was like, oh, you know, thanks a lot, you know, but you know, it's lovely to meet you. And he's like, no, please stay, you know, come and eat with us. So I ended up spending the whole evening with him. I said, I have this idea, you know, I'm working on this thing and I want to record the music on trains, you know, and I told him about the documentary. And he said, what a great idea. And his face lit up and he was the right guy to tell that to, you know, he didn't shut it down, which, you know, can be done. And so he was like, oh, yeah, you know, in the 80s I bought an open rail pass and I just traveled across Europe for a month. I didn't know where I was going in the morning and I just sort of like pick a place at the station and get on there and then find a hotel. And he said it was just the most fabulous experience. And you know, after that he's a great, you know, he told me he's a great advocate of train travel and stuff like that, and that encouraged me to approach it with this sort of spirit and playfulness. So I sort of like this serendipity that happens working on films. It's sort of something that I've done since day one, I think, with Praise, the first score I did with Dirty Three, where, you know, I realised that we had no idea how to score a film. And what we could suggest was, look, we're going to jam for 2 days. And if there's something there, you can use it. And we tried to do one cue and it was an absolute disaster. So we just sort of, you know, sent him, you know, like a couple of hours of jamming and he edited to it. then The Proposition was the next thing that I worked on a few years later. And again, it felt very much like that. We made that score in, I think, 4 days or something like that.
Wow.
Just sitting down and just bashing ideas out like we would do, trying to get ideas together for a band.
Yeah. That was one thing I wanted to ask, was whether it was, I guess, the journey that you've had in writing score must have kind of, you know, changed over the years. Like, I love that you know, that idea of, with Praise, of you just going, I don't know, let's just jam, let's just make some music.
Well, like, I guess you go into any situation armed with what you have, and so you have to approach it in that way. I'd had a experience working with people in bands, in Dirty Three and the Bad Seeds. You know, I'd had experience playing music, but you form your own way of doing something, and particularly things that seem terrifying are interesting to jump into.
Totally.
Even if you think you can't do it and you don't do it, then turn up and you fail, at least you've tried. And so I guess in these situations, like, you know, you think, okay, well, how do I know? What approach do I do this, and can it work? And some of the approaches changed, but it more or less stayed the same too. Certainly the way that I work with Nick on the scores, you know, in the last, since The Proposition and the films that I've done on my own, there's a certain sense of I've probably cued, I could count them on probably two hands how many actual cues I've done.
To picture, yeah.
And actually I feel really kind of confident in that area because in doing that, because I know when something does fall into place and you see these beautiful accidents happen, they're actually encouraging, you know, and you know, I don't know, I guess you just develop, like anything you do, you develop some method along the way as you're going.
But I guess because you have such a brilliant background, you know, in writing music and the way that you've done it, be it for, you know, for yourselves, Dirty Three, with Nick, with Grinder Man, all, and for all the score stuff and all the theatre things as well that you've worked with over the years, sort of thing. It's about an emotional connection. Is that what you're looking for?
I'm looking for a creative connection, and then I actually, for some reason, I have this ability. If you put a pile of stuff in front of me, I just go for it. And I continually buy things. I'm fascinated by the possibility of things. So for me, it's like the less I know something, the more exciting it is. You know, I'll buy a synthesizer and try and work out how I can use it. Obviously, it's not all just about chance and stuff, because then, you know, we sit and manipulate things. But up until now, like, you know, Ghostine, everything I've done, it's sort of diving into the unknown a lot of the time. And the things that you don't recognize are the things that are, or the things that sort of kind of seem a bit like, seem scary, are the things that you have to gravitate to.
Absolutely.
Rather than what you know. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, hopefully you're kind of moving forward in some way and away from what you've been doing. And you know, that's the only thing that's ever driven me, really, is to try and find a place somewhere in the process.
Mm-hmm.
I really remember doing The Proposition and having a bunch of music. We just sit down and play and play and play, you know, for hours.
Thank you.
I didn't even read the script. I mean, Nick wrote it.
Obviously, yeah.
But I didn't actually read it. And then the day before, I saw a cut of the film. I'd never done anything like this before. So, you know, I went in and saw a cut and with a bit of temp music put to it, but there was hardly anything. It was just sort of such a sort of like, you know, we were always like one step behind everything because they were still editing it, which is the story of films, it seems. We were always one step behind what was going on. And we worked with Jake Jackson. It was the first time we worked with Jake, who we've worked with on everything we've done, I think, except one film. I remember Gerard, who was sort of trying to edit, doing the music editor, he said, come and have a look at this. And he sort of laid out a track that we'd done, and it was the opening cue in the proposition, you know, when he sort of does his speech. And it just sort of played out perfectly and everything landed beautifully and nothing was touched on that piece, you know. It was just like put in and I'd never thought about making music for film, but I did have a thing in the back of my mind that was obviously you can make music, just see if it works.
Yeah.
If it does, it will. I mean, so I've kind of operated like that pretty much since day one, and accidents happen then, and you get these beautiful things that just occur, and there's a space and a sense of air, and also you get a great counterpoint going on because you're not trying to force things in any way.
With something like The Road, when you have this incredible piece of literature by Cormac McCarthy and then John obviously wants to put his creative stamp on it with his film, can you remember the kind of journey of that scoring? And had you read the book? And were you?
Oh yeah, I'd read the book. I don't think I read the script. I read the book of Jesse James as well, but I think I read the script after I saw the film. That was a kind of rather prolonged, because producers were kind of not getting the film they thought. You know, they had Brad Pitt, they had Jesse James, but they had this meditative kind of film that was long, and you know, it wasn't what they were expecting. So that was really problematic, that film, in a sense that Andrew's vision wasn't what they were anticipating.
Yeah.
So it was that film seemed constantly up against, I guess, you know, the powers that be. But I think Andrew ultimately got the cut that he wanted with that film.
You want the director's vision to be the thing that shines through rather than producers who have their, you know, the 5 pence worth.
I guess you do, but I mean, that's what they're there for. But you do need some guidance sometimes because you get so, and you want to hope that the producers that are on board, and it's not always the case, that they have some taste and that they can instruct you, because when you're working within something like that, you sometimes can get so lost. And I know this mixing records, it can take just somebody to say like, hey, you know, da 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 da, and you go, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm at an age where I actually like to listen to people's opinions. When I was 30, I wasn't interested at all. I mean, you know, it'd be just like, fuck you. But a lot of that was more out of, I guess, fear of my own incapabilities and fear of being questioned, you know. Like I sort of had to work out that I needed to listen to people in order to grow.
Yeah.
And I think for me, making music for film, we'd give Andrew stuff and he's like, I don't like it. And we're like, what? What the, you know, what? Like, you know. And actually Andrew pushed us back in, and if that score is good, it's because Andrew made us go the distance, because he,
wow,
luckily, you know, had this kind of idea for what he wanted with the film.
Yeah.
And he could articulate it and send us back in again, you know. And that was a very new experience for me, you know, working in a band. You just like sit in your own little world, and I've never worked in a band that's been accountable to a record label. You know, for better or worse, I've just been left to my own devices, basically. Yeah. And the bands that I work with have been left to their own devices. And as a result of that, you get this kind of mentality, and then you sort of find yourself in a situation where you're actually like a team player. And, you know, you're contributing to this kind of big project, which is a very different thing. And actually I've learned that the letting go in that process is actually incredibly liberating. And Jesse James taught me a big lesson with that you can walk into a room having let go of an idea that you thought was like so great.
Yeah.
And you just like put ego and all that crap behind you.
Yeah.
And just go in there with an empty plate and go, okay, mm-hmm, and see what happens. And, you know, I've seen a piece that like Bob come out of a situation like that. And when that happened, it was like, okay, you know, it's good to let go. Like, and I think that was a real point of a learning curve for me. Getting reading the book, and you know, I think like most people, a lot of people took that book to their heart, and I remember people writing to me when they heard, you know, like, I hope you don't fuck this film up.
Jesus.
Book up. And people I knew that they'd never even mentioned reading a book to me, people I didn't even think could read, you know. I actually remember after the film came out and being on a bus to some festival, and someone from a band coming up to me and just saying, you fucked the road up. And I was like, what? Like, oh, man. You know, like, I mean, it was interesting, that book, because it spoke to people in such a direct way.
Yeah.
And people had such a personal thing on it. And I think making a film about that book was always going to be difficult, because people had opinions about it so strongly.
Yeah.
But, you know, again with you know, like, I think that was like the third film that we'd done, and John wanted this kind of sort of simple music to offset the kind of the dreariness, and to also to sort of like support this kind of this what is a beautiful love story.
Mm-hmm.
about care, and it seems incredibly prescient at the moment.
Yeah.
The simple things of caring and being safe, you know. It was interesting. We performed our scores in Australia in December.
Yeah.
For the first time.
And how was that?
It was unbelievable. It was like, it felt like just a dream, like the most surreal dream, that suddenly the most extraordinary thing had sort of taken flight over 15 years, this collaboration, you know, of pieces that we go in and work and then move on and work and move on and, you know, play shows and do the Bad Seeds. And this sort of catalogue of music had been building up that, you know, I knew it was there, but I didn't anticipate the sort of what would happen when it was played by, you know, a 100-piece orchestra and a 40-piece choir, and to see these little ideas suddenly played by an orchestra that we'd made, you know, just in little studios and things like that, to suddenly see this new life blown into them and to be standing there playing with them. It was just like, I mean, you know, I think I must have shed a tear every night playing. It was, and looking at Nick to see his face as well, you know, and like it was so moving. And actually what was incredible was the stuff from the road was just so extraordinary up there, because they had it projected from the films. They had images. So we played a series of suites from six films. It was a sort of 90-minute thing with no interval. And the road images were extraordinary, but we were in Sydney performing them at the Opera House, and it's when the bushfires were on. So for 10 days we were under this haze of smoke that was so sort of apocalyptic. It was terrifying. It's the first time up until now that this sense of a power greater than anything was suddenly like forced upon everybody. And being in Sydney then, where you couldn't see the sky, like it was a sunset all day, and you're not prepared for how that shifts your emotions. And, you know, sirens going off all the time and alarms because the smoke is setting it off, and being in the hotel and it smells like smoke, and your instinct is to run, but it's just because the whole city smells of smoke. So it was quite strange wandering through this sort of landscape and then seeing the same thing up on the screen. It was very strange, but it was just an absolutely extraordinary experience, and such a privilege and honour to play, to hear these people play this music and to play with them.
Was it a different live experience for you then, would you say, than you've had before?
to playing in bands. Yeah, it was, because generally a band is on your terms. You turn up, you know that, you know, like I've played with Dirty Three for almost 30 years now, you know, like I've played From Her to Eternity for 25 years with the Bad Seeds, you know, like, you know, there's some material that you know, and that gives you a safety net. And you also know that you're up there and you know these people up there, and there's a sort of confidence in that, and there's a kind of, you know, this is very different because we'd only ever played the music once when it was recorded. So we had to sit down and learn somehow how to play this stuff with an orchestra. So I had to sit with my iPhone and learn from memory and write in an exercise book, just like letters and stuff, because I can't write. I can read music, but I haven't done it for so long and I couldn't read a score now. I mean, you know, I couldn't sit and play along. I'd be lost. So basically Nick and I had to just sort of learn from memory this 90-minute sort of thing. And so there was a lot of problems that could have been associated with it. You know, speaking, you feel like you're jumping into the unknown.
Yeah.
And it was actually very different because we were on their ground. We were on their terms because, you know, it's a group of 100-plus people that you've never played with before. And it was just sort of like, I knew Nick, of course, you know, but everyone else I didn't know. And it was actually amazing. It was sort of mind-boggling and very different in a way to, you know, I've played for 30 years, I guess, now live, you know, and still am nervous when I play, you know, and I like that, you know, I still like, how does this go again, or can we do this again? You know, it constantly sort of comes up, you know, like before each tour, and then you sort of get back into it. But
this was
actually very different. There was a lot of unknowns, and wonderfully it all sort of came together in the most beautiful way.
Oh man, I wish I'd seen that. Hopefully when we get through this current apocalypse, we can come out the other side and you guys might do some more of that. That would be amazing.
Yeah, at the moment there's a sort of rescheduled, and that, you know, with what's going on, you know, the decision was, you know, it was obvious that it was just impossible to do a tour at the moment. I mean, you know, there's definitely a thought to do more shows like this, like with the orchestra, and there's been an interest, you know, like there's orchestras all over the place that sort of wanted to do it.
How did you choose what films and pieces of music you would include? Was that an easy thing to decide?
It was actually the production in Melbourne that came up with the idea to do this. It was a young guy who had this idea to put it all together, and so I sat down and looked at it, and it's such a kind of big catalogue now. You know, there's, I don't know how many films, but there's quite a lot. And so, yeah, it was kind of, you know, just leaving it actually in there with them, because they came up with a list when they presented this. They said, you know, this is a potential list of material, and we looked at it, and a lot of it seemed really good, and we made a few suggestions, and then when the arranger stepped in, you know, we started fine-tuning it and things like that. But it was actually good to have, you know, it's good to let things out of your hands and let other people do it and delegate. And actually it was really good because they were able to find a way into it that we probably couldn't. You know, we would go, oh, this. And I mean, you know, ultimately we sort of like had the overview of it, but it was predominantly them who sort of suggested what might work. And also they had a good idea for how to make suites out of each film. So there was like a sort of 15-20 minute suite from each film that just segued into one another. And they had a good idea of the shape, a good shape for that. And actually you could see they had an idea for a shape for the program. You know, it started with the proposition, then it kind of moved into west of Memphis, then it went into the road, and then it went into Hell or High Water.
Brilliant.
Wind River, and then Jesse James to finish off. And halfway through the show, the choir joined in, you know, from Hell or High Water onwards. then the choir were involved in Jesse James. So by the time Song for Bob happened, it was just like, you know, it was actually interesting because you could, you know, the dynamics of an orchestra is so different. It's not about volume and amplification, which every band I'm in is basically about that, which is why I'm deaf. But it's really, you know, it's just about like turn up and away you go. And I mean, we've changed a bit over the years, and but this is actually, you know, it's all this acoustic sound on stage, which is extraordinary.
That's a physical effect on you.
It's so physical. You feel it through you. You feel it through your legs. Like you feel it through your body. It's incredible. Nothing, you know, like I've used strings a lot now in films, and it's still always like a miracle when you hear them start up in the studio. Like there's nothing like that sound of, you know, 20 string players or sort of 60-piece string section playing. You know, there's nothing like it. It can't be kind of recreated with the plugins or recordings. Like it, when you feel that actual physical energy in the room, it's extraordinary. And so to be actually standing there with that was incredible. But the dynamics could get down so quiet, you know, like in the road you would hear people sobbing in the audience. It was really extraordinary.
We've had David Michaud and David McKenzie on the podcast, and they both talked very highly of their experience of working with you guys on War Machine and Hell or High Water. And I loved Hell or High Water. I loved that film. So great. I wish more people had seen it, but hopefully they can now.
Yeah, working with David was fantastic. Both Davids, actually. We had a run of Davids at one point. We had David Earl Offen, who we did the Albert Camus book, Far From Men, the short story with Viggo Mortensen and Reda Kateb. Then we had David McKenzie and then David Michaud. It was like three Davids. I don't know what was going on.
The David trilogy.
It was the David trilogy. They were fabulous to work with. Really, really, really fabulous. David Michaud is extraordinarily precise. Him, Andrew Dominic, extraordinary as well. Like his sense of sound and music is just extraordinary. And Michaud as well, David Michaud is like just such an absolute pleasure to be around and work with, because he's just like, he blows my mind. You know, I love that guy dearly. He's so articulate and so precise and can point out things that you just don't even think of. Let's move this back two frames, and you're like, what? You know, there's this precision that's kind of, it's really amazing. And Denise, who I did Mustang with, she's another person that I'd just go over a cliff with. She's extraordinary, the way she can articulate things. Working with her, I learned some really invaluable lessons.
That score was, I mean, you know, you got quite rightly sort of a couple of awards for that score for Mustang, which was just, I mean.
Well, that film was just such a beautiful film. I'd been on tour with Nick in Australia playing shows, and what happened was I'd met her husband at a wedding, and we had a mutual friend, and we exchanged numbers because he said, oh, when she's in town, I'll text you and let's have a coffee together, you know, it'd be a laugh. And he texted me when I was in Australia and said, actually, my wife has made a film and she'd love you to see it and she to show it to you. And I said, well, look, I'm in Australia, I'm on tour, I'm not back until mid-January. So in the meantime, she contacted me and said, look, you know, I can show you this edit that I'm working on. And it was, I guess it was the end of January. And I went in and she was about to have a baby. And she just put the film on and walked out. And I watched the first sort of 5 minutes and it just sort of was so breathtaking, those running through the – it was so incredible. And the film finished and then she sort of came in and started talking about what she wanted. And I said, listen, Denise, I have to be honest with you. I have no time to do this. And I think they had a budget of like 1,200 euros. And there was like orchestral score and stuff. It was a lot of stuff temped with our music and it was orchestral. And I just said, you know, I've got to go back out on tour again. And like this film deserves better than somebody that can't give you any time, you know, like – you need to be able to work with someone closely. And she just looked at me and, you know, she's like, I don't know what to do because I can't imagine anybody else doing it. And I just
Said,
I'm really sorry, but I can't, you know. I have to say no because it's like unfair of me to agree to this and then lead it, you know, because you know with these things they want stuff and you can't do it and it's not fair on anyone. You know, I was trying to do the right thing. So she just said, okay, and walked out. And then I just sort of went home and felt so horrible because saying no is quite hard.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was working on a short film with Reda Kateb, who's a French actor who was in Far From Men, and he was in Spiral, that great.
Yeah.
He's Mr. Assi. He's like kind of the greatest bad guy to score. And fabulous actor. He's fabulous, fabulous actor. And I was doing music for his short film and I was kind of bummed because I'd said no. And he goes, no, you're right. You can't agree to things, you know, and just leave everybody confused. And he goes, you're right, you know. Like he said, you know, I'm not doing any film now except for this film on Django Reinhardt. And I'm learning how to play guitar and I just want to do this right. You know, I'm not doing anything for 12 months except this. And then he said to me, I'm doing this because it's a first director, first film, and the energy that's in that, you just don't get anywhere else. And as soon as he said that, I knew it was like this was what was incredible about Mustang was that it had this energy that was just – and this love you could sense in it. So I found a piece that I'd done for something else and I sent it to Denise and I said, look, you know, can we have a see what you can do with this? And she called me. And said, come and have a look. And I went and had a look and I said, okay, if that's a way you think we can work, then I'm up for it. I have like 6 days or something.
Wow.
And so, and yeah, and that's where that's, I just.
What a great story.
Yeah, I sat in the sort of, the studio that I'm isolated in now, in the back of the I just sat in there and worked out how, I, you know, with sitting with Jake, I'd sort of, watched a bit of Pro Tools going on and all that. So I sat there, worked out a kind of way of Frankensteinian way of doing Pro Tools and sort of made this the score for it, but really just like just throwing music down and then sending it to her. And eventually we edited, we actually mixed it over Skype and she was editing. She had the baby.
Wow.
She kept editing. I walked in the next time I saw her, she was sort of like had this sort of like 1 week old baby on her hip and still editing. And then we would mix, when we mixed it, it'd be on Skype and she would say, now when she walks through there, take the bass out now, bring it in when the door opens, you know, like it was all done like that. And it's still to this day one of the sort of most extraordinary experiences I've ever had doing something. Thank you.
And then you did Django as well. Off the back
then
of that.
Then I did Django as well on the back of that, and I was working with Bretta, and it was so funny, you know. Like, and then I ended up doing the sort of requiem for that Django film. Yeah, it was an incredible moment of serendipity, all that stuff. Yeah. And it was all connected to a couple of people, you know. Retta was in there, suddenly he's in that film. Mm. And, you know, I had lunch with Retta the other day just before all this kicked off. I left my scarf at his house and he mailed it to me.
Oh, yeah, I've just started writing letters to people as well, just because getting something through the post is kind of just, it's like, it's the simple things now that seem so important. Yeah. It's, yeah.
Well, I guess, yeah, the post is shut down as of today here.
Oh, has it?
Yeah, last week you couldn't send anything if you didn't have a stamp, and now it's closed. Here on the news, they're asking for any people with medical experience to please come and help.
Oh, Warren, crikey.
Yeah, it's very surreal.
Mm. Yeah.
It feels important to be talking about things, you know, it's why I wanted to do this interview.
Thank you.
It's kind of important that we tried that things can go on too, and but also, you know, that, you know, I hope everybody does the right thing by this, because it's an extraordinary moment.
Are you writing?
Yeah, well, I am. Yeah, I'm kind of actually. Yeah, I've got some things I'm working on. Most things have been shut down for me or rescheduled, you know. But yeah. I'm working on two films, and one of those was shut down. But I've been making music before they do it. It's for this extraordinary director Lucile Hadzilovic,
mm-hmm.
Who did Evolution and Innocence. She's a fabulous director. And I sort of have been putting music together, and in a different way, actually. And she originally only thought she'd have one piece, and I sent her sort of like about 15 ideas, and she said it sort of informed how she wants to sort of film it. But then the filming got sort of suspended. But she's been listening to these sort of soundscapes that I've been sending her, and she said that it's actually made her think about filming. So it might have a different place in it, the music. Yeah. So I'm sort of, you know, getting things together for that. And I also, there's another one. I was working in with Jake and Nick actually on 10 days ago in London.
Oh, man, at EO Studios.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And then I kind of went and, I sort of, when I realized what was going on, I went down to get my son from Sussex and bring him back.
Yeah. You surround yourself with wonderful people, because we were lucky enough to speak to Jake for the podcast as well. And the smile on that man's face
can like
brighten up anyone's day. What a wonderful human being he is.
Yeah. Jake's great. Jake's sort of, you know, we've, like I said, done every film with him except for one, which was that Lawless film. Yeah, Jake, it's a great working relationship with him, because we just pick up where we were, and we have a system, and we developed a way of working together as well, where we just do everything now. The three of us, me, Nick and Jake, sit and edit it, put it in, then it gets up to the director, they just chuck it out or throw it away or whatever. But, you know, we kind of have worked, developed this thing that's very lean now, this process.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but, and then I think about projects like Mustang and this Train I Ride and Bad Girl and these things that I do that actually give me even a greater independence beyond that have been really informative for other stuff that I do with the bands, you know, like in the way that Nick and I work together changes, you know, it changes all the time.
Yeah.
But it's always about just stepping into the sort of unknown and seeing what happens. You know, we just sit down and, you know, right through to the last thing, Ghostine. I think people that you know that bring out what's hopefully the best in you.
Yeah.
When you're with them, it allows this sort of zone where you know that you can fail and you know that you can try anything, because there's no fear of embarrassment or anything like that. I mean, it's really important, I think, for the whole creative process for that to happen, particularly in the way that we're working, you know. I think it's probably different when you're a writer or you're sitting on your own doing stuff, or you're an artist or whatever. But with this, it's, you know, it's actually when you're surrounded by people, you need to be allowed to be vulnerable and allow yourself to kind of shine and allow yourself to sort of just totally plummet. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm only as good as the people that are around me. I like the working with people that draw things out of me.
I can't believe it's 6 years ago since, I don't know if you remember, but I was lucky enough to be asked to host a wonderful night at the Barbican for 20,000 Days on Earth, where it was such a brilliant night. So they showed the film and Ian and Jane were there and you and Nick did a couple of songs with some other of the band, and then Ray Winston came up on stage and we did a bit of a Q&A with him. I mean, it was such a bonkers and brilliant night and such a great way to enthuse about that film, which in itself was such a unique entity because it wasn't one thing or the other. And I was talking to someone about it the other day who hadn't seen it. I was like, oh my God, you have to see it. It's such a clever piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, it is really good. It's a really great piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, Ian and Jane are great. Listen, I'm going to let you go. I've got to go and get ready for my geography lesson with my 11-year-old.
So you're getting on all right?
Yeah, we're fine. We're kind of, we're very lucky. Touch wood, we've not kind of had anything major. My husband and I are both sure we've had it, but in very, very kind of mild case of it, but you know, just taking advice and being sensible and looking after others. And
are you sort of isolating? And
we're locked down in the house, and you know, if our neighbors, we've got elderly neighbors close by, so we're just checking in on them, making sure they're okay. And
yeah, good. It's great, this sort of this thing that it's brought out in people. We've lost this sense of community, and it's coming back, and that's extraordinary.
I'm gonna have a virtual night at the pub with my friends tonight. We're all gonna we're going to get on a house party on the app and have a few drinks together and catch up that way. So
Goes, yeah. Well, have a mouthful for me.
Yeah, I will. I'll have a gallon. I'm Scottish. It's in my blood.
I have great memories of Scotland. In the late 80s, I lived
there. You spent a bit of time there, didn't you?
Yeah, I sort of cut my teeth playing on the streets there and living on a whiskey distillery and so it's why, you know,
yeah, I have a real a fondness for Scotland.
It's a pretty special place. I get
it's fabulous.
I get withdrawal symptoms from not getting up there as much as I'd like to, but it's a special place. Well, listen, Warren, take care. I hope you and your
father are doing
well. It's so great to chat to you. And
yeah, my pleasure.
If we're still here in a month, maybe we can catch up again. And
fabulous. Anytime.
All right. You take care. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Yeah,
lots Bye. Of love.
From the score to This Train I Ride, that's Mystery Train by Warren Ellis, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the Australian composer and musician. My huge thanks to Warren for taking the time to talk to us from his studio in these most troubled of times. If nothing else, now provides the perfect opportunity to revisit his back catalogue with his score for This Train I Ride, available via our very good friends at Invader Records. Head to edithbowman.com to hear my chats with David McKenzie, David Michaud and Jake Jackson. And please do subscribe whilst you're there. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do check out and subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Next up, it is Isabel Waller-Bridge who joins me to discuss her score for Emma, amongst many other things. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. Meantime, please stay safe.